Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
What happens when a radioactive Superfund site is in a floodplain?
Because we're doing the design right now, now's the perfect time to design those preventions into the plan. It just makes sense to do it, to try and plan for worst case scenario while we're constructing it, so we don't have to go back when we have some kind of a failure.
It's Tuesday, April 23rd. It's also Science Friday. I'm Sci-Fi producer Charles Berquist. A landfill near St. Louis contains tons of radioactive waste. It's also near the Missouri River in an area that can flood. And it's not alone. Across the country, there are many other toxic sites threatened by flooding due to climate change. We'll talk about the history of the site and what's being done to control that risk. Here's Sci-Fi's John Dankosky.
The first Earth Day in 1970 launched a decade of environmental activism, which pushed U.S. lawmakers to take action. In just the first few years of the 1970s, the Environmental Protection Agency was created, and legislation was passed to protect drinking water and save endangered species, among other things. But by the end of that decade, there were still serious environmental problems, including the remnants of decades of chemical pollution. Our next story focuses on some of the most highly polluted areas of the country. They're called Superfund sites, and a big chunk of them, more than 300, are found in areas that are in danger of flooding. Sheila Farzon's been reporting on this story for us. She's a science journalist and editor with American Public Media. Sheila, great to have you back.
Great to be here.
So these Superfund sites are pretty common, right?
Right. Yeah, there's actually more than 1,300 of these sites across the U.S., and you can find them in pretty much every state, so there's a good chance you've got one near you. About 78 million people live within 3 miles of a Superfund site. That's almost one in four Americans.
Wow, that's a big number. So, I mean, what exactly is in these sites?
Lots of different things. So depending on the site, there's everything from lead and asbestos to radioactive waste. A lot of these chemicals take a really long time to break down and can cause pretty serious health problems like cancer.
Let's talk about where you live in Missouri, Sheila, a place that has more than 30 of these Superfund sites. And there's one not too terribly far from where you live in St. Louis. Could you tell us about this?
Yeah, it's called the Westlake Landfill, and it's about a mile and a half from the Missouri River. And buried underground there is about 300,000 cubic yards of radioactive waste. It's hard to know exactly how much is there because radioactive waste just tends to contaminate everything it touches, but it's enough to fill up more than 18,000 full-size dump trucks.
Wow, that's a lot of waste. I mean, how did so much radioactive waste get dumped by a major river anyway? I mean, why did people think that was a good idea?
Yeah, it's actually left over from the Manhattan Project. So back in the early 40s, right around the time the U.S. entered World War II, a company in St. Louis started processing uranium ore. And that uranium was used in some of the first atomic weapons tests. And this particular company in St. Louis made a lot of it, somewhere around 1 ton of uranium oxide every day by 1942. And in doing so, they also made a lot of waste that they just didn't know what to do with. So more than 100,000 tons of radioactive waste got dumped across St. Louis. Some of it was stored outside in barrels, which leaked into a creek. And a bunch more of that radioactive waste got dumped into a residential landfill.
Okay, and that's the site we're talking about today, the Westlake Landfill. So this radioactive waste is near the Missouri River. Does that area flood?
Yes. So the landfill is behind a levee, but this area definitely can flood, and it does. So one of the last times that that happened was back in July 2022. We had this series of really intense thunderstorms roll through St. Louis that brought a lot of rain, like almost 8 inches in 6 hours. And
Wow. And
by the end, some spots had gotten a foot of rain.
A foot of rain. Wow. So what happened at the Superfund site?
I talked with Dawn Chapman about that. She's an activist who lives near the Superfund site, and she's been pushing the government to clean it up for more than a decade. She drove over there in the morning to check on the site, and here's how she described it.
Westlake was an island. It was an island. It was flooded on all sides. It had, you know, it had built up and come up around the landfill. It never surpassed it and came over the top, But what did happen is the rain fell so fast and so strong that it actually took chunks off the landfill.
Wait, so the rain was washing away chunks of a landfill?
Well, so years before, the EPA, who's the one that's in charge of the site, had covered the landfill with a special type of fabric and gravel just to try to contain that radioactive waste. But the rain had been so heavy that in some spots it just washed the gravel right into the floodwaters.
So does that mean that there was radioactive contamination washing away too?
Fortunately, no. I asked Chris Jump about this. She's the EPA's remedial project manager for this site. And she said the gravel did wash away in some areas, but when they went back and tested stormwater from about a dozen different spots around the landfill, the EPA didn't find any radioactive contamination. Here's Chris.
We were actually surprised, pleasantly surprised, that, you know, we had such positive results. I mean, it showed, basically shows that, yeah, there are some steep slopes that have a potential for erosion, but it was controlled to the extent that we didn't see any migration of the contaminants themselves.
And I should mention that unrelated to this particular flood, the EPA has found that pollution from the landfill is seeping into the groundwater under the site. It's mostly things like solvents and petroleum products, but small amounts of that radioactive contamination have moved offsite.
Let's get back to Missouri in just a bit, but I want to talk about how this all started in the first place. How exactly did these Superfund sites come to be?
The Superfund program started back in 1980, and what sparked it was this series of high-profile environmental disasters in the late 70s. One of them happened in this place called Love Canal in upstate New York. Years earlier, a chemical company had dumped toxic waste into this canal, which eventually started leaching up out of the ground and into yards and basements. And things got really bad really fast. Kids were born with serious birth defects, like multiple ears and multiple sets of teeth. And eventually, the feds actually declared a state of emergency and moved hundreds of families who lived there. And that's just one example, John, because there was lots of waste being dumped all over the U.S.
Where exactly was all this chemical waste coming from?
A lot of it was connected to the manufacturing boom that happened after World War II. So people were really eager to spend money on household goods and appliances and cars. So factories started making more stuff and producing more industrial waste. But at the same time, there weren't that many laws controlling how companies got rid of these chemicals. So they just kind of dumped them wherever they wanted, which usually was rivers and streams and landfills. And this was happening everywhere, but manufacturing hubs like St. Louis really got the brunt of this pollution. I talked with Missouri State Representative Doug Clemens about this. He grew up in St. Louis, right next to a creek contaminated with toxic waste.
I'm from Northwest County, St. Louis. We were, post-World War II, the industrial base for Missouri. You know, we had Ford, we had a refrigeration company, we had a paint company, we had all of these areas which have left behind contaminants. It was very convenient for factories to just leave things behind or put them out the back door, which have soaked into the soil.
But like we said, by the late 1970s, it sounds like, I don't know, this was starting to change.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, more people were getting worried about this, and that put pressure on U.S. lawmakers. So by 1979, lawmakers were holding hearings on toxic waste. And by the following year, they'd passed legislation on it, which created the Superfund program. And that program is managed by the EPA. And the goal is basically to force polluters to clean up these sites.
Okay, so let's fast forward to the present. We know that climate change is making flooding more intense and more frequent, and we know that hundreds of these Superfund sites are in areas that can flood. How about the chemicals that are actually being moved around by this floodwater?
Yeah, it's a good question. So there's three main ways that these chemicals can kind of move around in the floodwaters. So you can have water flowing over contaminated dirt and moving that dirt around. You can have chemicals that are already in water, like maybe a contaminated pond. And then the flood mixes with that polluted water. Or you can have chemical reactions happening where the water actually reacts with the pollutants in the sediment, and then those chemicals are released up into the water.
But then where do they end up? I mean, are they going to storm sewers, into rivers?
Well, it's going to depend on a lot of different factors, honestly. Like, what kinds of chemicals are there? Is the land pretty flat or hilly? Even how fast the floodwater is moving.
And could they seep into the ground and contaminate drinking water, too?
Yeah, that can happen because groundwater and surface water are a connected resource. So if a flood, let's say, sweeps through a Superfund site, some of that contaminated water can flow back into the river, and then some could seep underground into groundwater.
Well, that sounds concerning.
Yeah, it does. But there's an important caveat here that I think we should mention. And I heard it from Becca Newman. She's an associate professor at the University of Washington, and she studies how contaminants move around in the environment. And she said it's not just whether a specific chemical is there or not, because every chemical is going to be a little bit different in terms of how it moves in the environment, how it affects human health. Here's what she said.
So what matters is its concentration and the nature of the chemical, right? So there are some chemicals that we can say are contaminating the landscape, but are having kind of minimal impact on human health or minimal impact on ecosystem health. And then we can have other chemicals at, you know, extremely trace levels that are almost non-detectable that could actually be quite harmful. So it's not just its presence that matters. It's like these other pieces.
And John, that's what makes this issue so hard to study. There are just so many different types of toxic chemicals out there, and we're just starting to understand a lot of them in terms of their health impacts, even sometimes their basic chemistry. So one scientist might spend their entire career just trying to understand one chemical when there are thousands of others out there in the environment.
And it seems like that could make things pretty complicated. I mean, especially if we're talking about sites with decades of pollution, we don't know everything that's in there. Now, you talked about the human health impacts. Who exactly is most at risk here?
It varies from site to site, but you usually find Superfund sites in communities that are low income and whose residents are mostly people of color. Part of this has to do with racial discrimination and all the different ways it's affected housing practices and limited where people of color live.
Yeah, and I imagine that these communities are already pretty vulnerable, right?
Yeah, that's the thing. I mean, they're already less equipped to handle environmental disasters, like, let's say, a big flood that washes pollution from a Superfund site. I talked with Laura Cushing about that. She's an assistant professor of environmental health sciences at UCLA. Here's what she said.
You know, during flood events, low-income households have fewer resources to prepare and weather these events. So low-income households and families of color are also less likely to have adequate insurance, more likely to rent their home as opposed to owning it, and as a result, not benefit as much from federal assistance after natural disasters. And they're more likely to be displaced after major flood events.
This week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, I'll talk with psychologist Jonathan Haidt about his book, The Anxious Generation.
We're overprotecting in one place, and I'm saying, lighten up, let your kids out. And we're underprotecting in another, and I'm saying, don't let your kids spend 9 hours a day on the internet talking with strange men. It's just not a good idea.
Jonathan Haidt on the New Yorker Radio Hour from WNYC Studios. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Again, 78 million people live near a Superfund site. But this is something that affects everybody, whether you have one of these sites in your city or not. Because we're talking about water, right? Like, river systems in the U.S. are totally interconnected. They cross state lines, they filter into aquifers and into groundwater. They're something that our ecosystems obviously depend on, not to mention our agriculture.
It raises the question about what to do with all this information, Shayla. I mean, we're talking about things getting worse in the future. Maybe we can talk about how well this program's working now.
If we just look at the raw numbers, the EPA has cleaned up more than 450 Superfund sites since the program first started. But there's still more than 1,000 left on that list, and more being added constantly. One of the main criticisms of this program is that it's slow. Like, it can take years or sometimes even decades for a site to get cleaned up. And sometimes that has to do with funding and bureaucracy. But a big part of this is that the EPA follows a pretty rigorous science-based process for each site. And sometimes science just moves much slower than what we want it to.
So what about more flooding that might come with climate change? Is that something that the EPA is planning for?
Yes. So the EPA has been aware of this issue for years. Back in 2012, they evaluated how vulnerable each Superfund site was to climate change effects. So not just flooding, but also things like wildfires. And they've been training their project managers on how to incorporate climate change risk into the cleanup plans for each Superfund site. But a lot of this climate change planning is super site specific. So what you do to secure one site in California might be really different from what you do for another site in Missouri.
So, yeah, let's go back to St. Louis and that Superfund site near the Missouri River that we talked about earlier, the West Lake Landfill. Is the EPA taking climate and flooding into account there?
So they do have a plan to clean up the radioactive waste at the landfill. And as part of that planning, they're using climate modeling to predict what things might be like at the site in the future. And the model suggests the site's going to get an additional inch of rainfall every month by 2050. And it's also going to have more violent rainstorms.
Sure. I mean, we're talking about radioactive contamination, though, right? I mean, that's something that sticks around for a long time.
Yeah, absolutely. Plus, there's still going to be some radioactive waste left behind at the site, even after cleanup is finished. And you're right, that waste takes a really, really long time to break down. In some cases, thousands of years. And no one knows what the future is going to look like at this site 500 or 1,000 years from now.
How do you even plan for something that far in the future?
Yeah, I asked Chris Jump about that. Remember, she's the EPA's remedial project manager for the landfill. And she said that when it comes to climate change specifically, it's a lot easier to plan for the worst case scenario now and include that in the cleanup design than try to go back and fix things later.
Because we're doing the design right now, now's the perfect time to design those preventions into the plan. It just makes sense to do it, to try and plan for worst case scenario while we're constructing it so we don't have to go back when we have some kind of a failure.
And Chris acknowledged that the community is impatient and they want this process to move faster. And I think that's the tension in a lot of communities, not just St. Louis. You have toxic waste that needs to be removed, a climate crisis that's threatening a lot of these sites, and a sometimes slow-moving cleanup process. And so I think the question that we're left with is, can we clean up or at least secure these waste dumps before the worst effects of climate change are felt?
That was science journalist and editor Shayla Farzon. Thanks so much for sharing this reporting with us, Shayla.
Thanks so much for having me.
If you'd like to learn more about Superfund sites around the U.S. that might be a risk during floods, you can go to sciencefriday.com/superfund. Thanks also to St. Louis Public Radio for their help with that story.
And that's it for today. Lots of folks helped make the show happen, including
Annie Nero,
Jason Rosenberg,
Rasha Aridi,
Shoshana Buxbaum.
Next time, why plastics pollution is such a hard problem to tackle and what we can do about it. Thanks for listening. I'm Sci-Fi producer Charles Bergquist. We'll see you soon.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at the New Yorker. So join us every week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.